Welcome to Biota Live. I'm Tom Barbalay, and this is a continuation of the Biota Podcasts. For a minute leading in there, we had four callers on the line. We are now down to three, so in a somewhat unusual procedure, I'm going to introduce each of the callers as they come on the air. So if you're waiting, I'll start with just a line first, because I do identify his number. Hello, Justin.
Hello, how are you doing, sir?
Good to speak to you today. We have a couple of other people on the line currently and a potential of a third, so no names associated with the numbers, so I'm just going to bring them in. Hello, caller number one.
Hello, that might be me.
Is that Jeffrey?
No, this is Robert Rice. In front of
you. Good to speak to you. This is the first time we've had a chance to chat. I will bring in caller number two. Hello, caller number
Hello.
Two. Is that
Hello.
Gerald?
Yes, it is.
Good to speak with you, Gerald. And we have now the fourth caller.
It's Jeffrey.
Hello, Jeffrey.
Hi.
So, for the first 90-minute show, we have four callers on the line already. The way that we do this normally is obviously I have quite a few pages of news and notes to go through. Justin, why don't you start by introducing what's going to be going on in London this week?
Well, certainly. We're going to have the first Grey Thumb London session happening on the 20th. And it's going to be the first one. I was hoping to have Bruce talk, but as I don't know if everyone knows, but he's not going to be able to make it this time. So I've been shanghaied, so to speak, into giving the first talk.
It's going to be hard for you, Justin, I'm sure.
What's that?
You've never talked about artificial life in the past, have you?
And there's nothing more dangerous than giving me a bully pulpit, so I look forward to it. And it's from 3:30 in the afternoon until 5:30, and we're meeting at a very hip, cool venue called the Charlotte Street Hotel in their screening room. And anyone and everyone is invited to come. It's, buy your own beer and or drinks or whatever it is you want, and just come listen. If people have ideas or things that they want to bring, we'll open it up. We'll be more than happy to let people jump up and talk about their projects. And it's just going to be the first session, kind of kicking it off. We're expecting a few people, but not a lot. So it's a good opportunity for those people in artificial life who are in the London area or in the United Kingdom and can make it to London to pop in and share what they're doing.
Now, in terms of local universities in and around London, have you approached any of the local universities?
I did. I spoke last week to a professor named Tatiana who's working on intelligent agents on her PhD, and have asked her to extend the invitation to the University of Surrey and hope to hear back from her tomorrow or on Monday morning. And we'll also be putting flyers up at the University of Surrey in Guildford, as well as some of the surveys, some of the universities around town.
Sorry, are you going to make the flyers available online for people in and around London who want to print out the flyers as well?
That is a great idea, and I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Do you have access to the Grey Thumb site currently with regards to this?
With respect to what, the blog?
Are you going to, for example, have a wiki page associated with what's going on at Grey Thumb London, which would be an ideal place to put the flyers, for example?
I do have access to the wiki. Yeah, I could do something with the wiki, and I'm still waiting. We're having a bit of problems with my blogging posts. But maybe you could put a post on the Grey Thumb site, Tom, since yours is still working.
Most definitely,
And I hit the wrong button and did something wrong, and Brian's trying to fix it.
Yeah.
But the wiki, yeah, we could definitely put something up on the wiki. That's a great idea. Maybe you and I could work on that after the call.
Certainly. It's very easy for... I'm not sure about the wiki. I've never played with the wiki, but certainly with regards to the blog, it's all too easy for me to post. Sometimes I feel guilty about the number of posts I make on the Grey Thumb blog.
If you'll take care of the blog, I'll make the wiki page.
Okay. We shouldn't really have a management meeting on the call because we do have a new caller. So, new caller, could you please introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. My name's Robert Rice. I've got a bit of a background in virtual reality, virtual worlds, and online games. And I met Justin about almost a year ago, and we've kind of been collaborating on some things. So,
terrific.
I'm also the author of MMO Evolution.
Great. Well, it's good to have you on the call, Robert. With regards to additional Grey Thumb news, March 3rd, the original Grey Thumb in Boston, Bruce Damer will be opening for Leonard Polovsky, who sounds like a fascinating fellow, actually. I was reading his bio. Bruce is going to be talking about the Evo grid, which obviously he's talked about in the past on this podcast and has now been featured in various blogs and other places talking about the Evo Grid as well. So people in the Cambridge, Massachusetts area, it will be at the Asgard Irish Pub on March 3rd, which I think it's traditionally on a Monday, so I'm assuming it's Monday, March 3rd. 350 Cambridge Avenue, Cambridge, Massachusetts, to see Biota's own Bruce Damer, and I believe he's going to be buying a round of drinks for people, so it's probably even more reason to attend. In addition, for folks listening in, I probably said this, but this is a continuation of the Biota podcast. For more information, biota.org/podcast. We normally do this Friday evening, 8 p.m. Pacific. We will do it again this coming Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific, but then I'm taking a couple of weeks off. The topic for this Friday will be outstanding questions, and there have been a number of outstanding questions that have been raised through these Biota Live chats to date, and some of them I wanted to talk about were the ideas of genetics and sustainability, some of the softer stuff with regards to language and culture, and various other topics. And if you have a topic or a question of interest that you would like to email me about before the show, tom@noble8.com, you can also find my contact details via biota.org/podcast. So, in addition to this, Dick Gordon's book, we're still looking for participants. I received quite a bit of correspondence last night from Dick with regards to the progress of the book. I know, Justin, are you part of the book project, or is it just Gerald so far?
I did send a message into Dick suggesting that I'd be happy to volunteer on a couple, maybe one or two, but I needed him to email me some of the, I needed to actually read what the authors had written to make sure I could provide a cogent, intelligent response.
Certainly. I've participated now in 3 out of 4 dialogues, and unfortunately, I haven't received a single response back from the people that I've participated with. However, there is still, half a month, so probably the end of February, and it may be extended into March just due to the logistics. I know, Gerald, you've probably received the email and gotten some email back to Dick already with regards to the book as well.
I've received the email, but I haven't gotten back to him yet. I've been a little tied up.
Certainly, certainly. And for folks interested, Dick is organizing what seems to be an amazing task in terms of the number of participants and the number of areas that are being written on, and logistically his responses to email have typically taken 3 or 4 days, but it's understandable with regards to what he's doing. Now, additional point of news, I was cruising past the Wikipedia entry on artificial life yesterday, and I noticed that Jay Lemon had made a number of changes. Folks will remember Jay Lemon from the Biota Interviews series. His interview is the most popular interview to date. Each month it seems to be downloaded by about 150 to 200 people, which is phenomenal, perhaps because it's attached to the Wikipedia artificial life entry. But going through the entry, I was very, very impressed. I probably shouldn't plug this too much because he does mention me by name in the artificial life entry, but I was impressed that the International Society of Artificial Life, Biota.org, and Grey Thumb were all given equal weighting. And if you look at those three organizations in terms of their structure, they are all very different. Obviously, the International Society of Artificial Life is paid membership. However, it's relatively cheap. I think it's about $65, which is even cheaper for folks in the UK and Europe currently, and that gives you the 4 journals through the year from MIT Press. Obviously, Biota, you're free to listen, you're free to participate. We are not taking any money. We will not be taking any money in the foreseeable future, even though we will be buying beer for the Grey Thumb folk in Boston. And Grey Thumb is a grassroots group, which we're aiming to evangelize through this live radio show and also see other chapters being launched. Gerald, in terms of your locale, do you think it's an ideal location for a Grey Thumb, or is there a city near you where you think a Grey Thumb could be located?
Well, Holland is not a terribly big country, so if you pick somewhere in the middle, everybody could get there.
Certainly. And Robert, where are you located?
I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, outside the Research Triangle Park.
Wow. So that would be an ideal location for a Grey Thumb as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've got Chapel Hill and a lot of IBM people down here, and a pretty large group of game developers and whatnot. So, yeah, it would be pretty good, I think.
Yeah, a good number of universities as well, and yeah, no, it seems like an ideal location for a Grey Thumb. So based on Justin's experience with Grey Thumb London and Bruce's experience with Grey Thumb Silicon Valley, maybe, Robert and Gerald would consider creating Grey Thumbs in their local areas. They seem to be well located. How many artificial life conferences were there within 2 hours commute from where you are, Gerald, last year?
Artificial life conferences?
Well, things that vent into artificial life. I seem to remember that whole area had three venting artificial life conferences in the past year. I think you attended one of them, but perhaps I'm mistaken.
Well, these aren't what you would call artificial life conferences, I suppose. They're in the academic community, of course, you've got artificial intelligence conferences, but artificial life, I don't think, is considered a typical academic conference circuit item.
Maybe it's not the specific point of the conference, but it tends to be a dot point in a series of other things, including the ethics of artificial intelligence and various other things. So certainly the conferences I've heard about have come through the Artificial Life mailing list, which seems to touch on a wide variety of conferences, whether they have anything explicitly to do with artificial life or not. I mean, there is so much, obviously, as folks listening in will appreciate, there is so much venting into artificial life that I think all these conferences aren't explicitly artificial life conferences, but they have something to do with one of the many facets of artificial life. And I seem to recall that your part of the world was very well represented in terms of these kind of conferences last year.
Well, there's some artificial intelligence conferences around, and I presented at one of them, of course, twice, actually. And that's something that happens in different cities every year, and twice a year, I think, actually.
Certainly.
But that's just one of many. There are several. It's all sort of, it's all really the academic community, right?
I believe so, but I think increasingly and certainly the correspondence through the Artificial Life mailing list seems to indicate that they will take pluralists, generalists, and non-academics at these conferences as well. I mean, that's your experience. You're not an academic yet. You delivered a project paper, didn't you?
Yeah. I don't know how I got in there, but I was lucky.
I think they'll take all, basically. So no, that was just something that I observed, that there are areas that seem to be getting a lot of conferences in your part of the world was one of them. Now, I did have a mini question that came up from something that Justin had said, I think probably at the last Saturday podcast. However, as we all appear to be on the line, it's probably better that we delve into the topic of discussion today. Actually, with Robert on the line, maybe I will raise this as a starting question that we can then move into the main topic. Justin, when you were talking two Saturdays ago, you mentioned that the future looked rosy for artificial life in terms of advanced intelligent agent systems and things like that, in terms of the development and use, and you used the heavily loaded date 2012 in terms of when you thought that this technology would become available. In my own thinking, and certainly my own thinking with regards to the singularity movement in particular, my concern has always been about the lack of discussion of how we actually get to that point in time. And you did give kind of brief sketch in terms of how this was going to play out in terms of big business, but you also made some comments that the folks that participate in these calls and hobbyist artificial life developers and people that are actively thinking and using contemporary artificial life simulations would be part of this as well. Can you just talk a little bit about that and perhaps bring Robert in as well in terms of how you see this unfolding towards a date in the future?
Well, first off, why is 2012 a loaded date?
Because of the singularist movement.
What is that?
Okay. Well, if you're unaware of the singularist movement, my view is you probably need to look at the Singularist Institute of Artificial Life and explore that through Wikipedia.
Okay,
but aside from
it. Now, an aside, the 2012 comment came, I mean, in 2001, 2002, I developed a computer simulation of the entire simulation science artificial life community using system dynamics coupled with discrete flows. And then I published the results in a very obscure academic journal saying that the tipping point for artificial life simulation science would occur 2006-2007, and a virtual world powered by artificial life engines would come in 2012-2013. I had no idea that there was any other insight into this, but what happened
Ray Kurzweil is the name that is most associated with the singularist movement.
I've heard of his name, but I've never read any of his books.
Well, it's amazing that you in fact, a number of people have come to this 2012 date through what appears to be independent means. So you could be another 2012 visionary in this regard. However, my interest is in terms of the folks that are listening to this radio show or podcast, how do they actively contribute into getting this technology developed and implemented?
Well, Robert, do you want to jump in or you want me to go first?
Could you actually repeat it? I just caught the last half.
Okay. So Justin, in what he does, takes, well, I think probably Justin is better to define what he does, but the discussion that he's raised to date is with regards to taking ideas in contemporary artificial life and moving them into a sphere of corporate entities and things of this nature that can use this technology in a way to power aspects of their business that are currently being done inefficiently. The comments that he made with regards to this in the last Saturday internet radio show was with regards to the fact that the contemporary group that having these discussions, I mean, my view in some regard is that when big business discovers the BIOS podcast, perhaps there'll be some kind of, I don't know, collapsing or something like that in terms of the topics of discussion. But I'm interested in Justin adding more color to that and giving more light to how folks who are listening in and contributing either through email or actively being part of these internet radio shows can contribute to that movement. And I was just looking for him to give a kind of greater definition to that.
Okay, sure. I mean, if you look at things like what a lot of the people in the artificial life community are doing, they're moving towards the ability to create a life form. And what is the purpose of these life forms? Well, one is entertainment. But increasingly, I think companies or enterprises, once they've modeled the physics of the reality using, advanced nonlinear mathematics, there's nothing to prevent us from having the artificial life forms step in and take over the management of some of the more complicated business processes. For example, a concrete real-life example where a client is actually paying us money to do this is for one of the world's largest gas companies, oil and gas companies. They've got a very complicated business process that's totally screwed up. And what they've hired us to do is to, step one, create 4 simulation models that map the physics of those processes in, some level of detail, nauseating levels of detail. And then what we're doing is we're combining that with artificial life forms to actually look at ways, because these systems are so complicated, you put out a fire in one spot and another fire breaks out in another spot, and the next thing you know, you've got a raging inferno burning around you all because you tried to put a fire out in place A. And in that doing so, you destroyed the whole business. So what they're trying to do is say, well, can we have this artificial life form actually move all of the levers of our business and help us identify quickly, cost-effectively, the right strategies to manage this highly complicated business process? So they're a classic innovator or early adopter, but once that word gets out, then of course, obviously, every corporation in the world will want to do it. So it's a way of making money. Why wouldn't they want to do it?
What Gerald said a couple of Saturdays ago left me thinking in terms of the idea. If you look at similar engineering hobbies, maybe artificially like artificial life, but maybe thought of in similar ways by the broader business community, an example would be, for example, a model train hobbyist that had built Boston to New York in terms of all the all the ins and outs of trains going from Boston to New York in his basement. And he had developed a plan in terms of doing this in his basement and then going to Amtrak or whatever the company is that is doing that and saying, I have this elaborate model that I have developed which maps directly onto your business model. Employ me. And I think that's the problem currently with the hobbyist community, at least, of artificial life developers, that we're all, in some regard, tinkering in our basements, and it's a means of communicating what we are developing to this business community, which I think, as you say, it may be a case, and people always talk about Mozilla in terms of getting open source into the business community, but it may be a case where it does need one initial movement up into that community. But certainly what I've been thinking about the stuff that I do with Intel and Apple, and that is still very much grassroots in terms of dealing with low-level engineers and engineering managers, but at a very low structural level. And the kind of turnaround that you are describing, particularly with regards to the date in the future, is an idea that the upper managers actually realize the power of this technology as well, and then begin to adopt it in a very real fashion, where they come back to the artificial life developers, the artificial life hobbyists, the artificial life academics, and say, show me the way in some regard. Is this what you're saying?
Well, can I jump in? What I would say is, I just got an offer this past week to run any artificial life engine that can. And I think, Tom, you and I could manage this, and maybe Jeffrey and Gerald would help. And Robert, I don't know if you want to get involved in this, but I got an offer to run an artificial life engine on 10,000 nodes on a BlueGNP, which is I don't know if y'all are familiar with the BlueGNP architecture.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, and that comes from, it's a big company called IBM, and they have all sorts of resources, and they're very keen on being able to do this. So if there's any artificial life developers out there that want to really see, hey, instead of tinkering as a hobbyist on five machines, and I don't work for IBM, I don't get any money from IBM, this is pure, this is not a commercial discussion, I'm just saying, if you have a technology, let's run it up there, let's do it on 4,000 nodes, 10,000 nodes, and see what emerges when we have that kind of horsepower.
When you talk about artificial, this is Jeffrey. Are you, when you refer to artificial life, are you talking about using genetic algorithms, evolutionary adaptation, which would distinguish it from classical AI?
Yeah, I don't do anything in the term. I don't like the term AI. The term I use, why I use artificial life, would be instead of, unlike genetic algorithms, where you define as an explicit fitness function. I'd rather see, and this comes from the work that Adam has done around creating what's called a reward function, and this reward function allows you basically cracking the algorithms of evolution for the ability for the algorithms to be grown, if you will, or some ways that Adam has explained it to me is that the evolution, the neoterics, the little life forms that live within the side of the computer chip, they actually eat the problem.
I mean, certainly contemporary artificial life is a wide variety of ideas, including genetic algorithms.
Yeah, to me, artificial intelligence, as they commonly refer to it, I refer to as the intelligent design approach to creating intelligence. It ain't never going to work, which is why I think the current approaches that you see, like in the Minsky labs and stuff like that, they've just consistently hit roadblocks and barriers to their success. But Jeffrey, you know a lot more about this than me, so you should jump in here. I mean, I'll shut up now.
Well, I think maybe what you're referring to is that by referring to it as artificial life, you have these agents that are intimately embedded into the problem space, and they adapt and grow within the problem space, so they're able to solve that problem space instead of being sort of built top down from the outside.
Yeah, what is the approach that you take? That's exactly what I'm talking about. But how do you approach it?
Well, I'm not trying to solve the same kinds of problems, so I don't know if I can draw a parallel. But I created one little evolutionary algorithm for evolving musical pieces, which I wrote a chapter for one of the Springer books coming out soon, and I also created artificial life evolution for gene pool, which is my sort of a game-like simulation that most of you are familiar with, which of course does not use an explicit fitness function. But I think I'm trying to solve different problems, like entertainment and just sort of helping people learn about evolution.
There's also one reason why I asked Rob to join us.
Yes. I mean, I think there's also, in terms of development, there's a distinction between IBM saying, because, I mean, this is my relationship with Intel fundamentally, Give us your code. We'll run it on, you know, N number of processors, N number of machines. We'll get exciting feedback that we utilize for our own development, and you get the exciting feedback of having the privilege of your code being run on the machines. And a business venture which involves a company saying, we need your knowledge, we're going to pay for your knowledge, we're going to pay for you to, you know, come in and use these machines. And I think my concern with regards to the idea of the artificial life hobbyist holding these secrets or these ideas which are, may exist through open source or may exist within their own heads, being utilized by big business, tends to gravitate towards the model where they say, you're excitable, you're easygoing, come in, run your code on our computers, we'll tinker away with the results, and that's great, you know, everyone's happy. And my feeling is that this isn't the same as the kind of top-down description that you're offering in terms of big business actually changing things through a degree of mutual respect. And I think this is the interesting mechanism, which I think in your own meta-thinking you should think about quite heavily in terms of how, aside from a huge knowledge base and aside from a wide variety of things that exist in open source, actually utilizing that to change the business processes and the thinking of business on a higher level. And I think that is the fascinating problem and really the reason that I brought it up for our collective thinking today. So, Justin, what I might do is I might leave you with that, and we might bring you back on a future podcast to discuss it, because I know Gerald wanted to discuss this topic, and we've taken up quite a bit of time with regards to this, although it bends into artificial life isn't intelligent design quite perfectly. Now, in setting up this topic, obviously we had a long discussion last Saturday that went over time, and I think there were a number of interesting areas, and in setting up how we would discuss this today, I've left an almost blank page in terms of just starting with the general recap and seeing how we go from there. Gerald, you have the floor.
Okay, well, let me see. Intelligent design, let me just read from the Wikipedia here. Intelligent design is the assertion that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as natural selection. It is a modern form of the traditional teleological argument for the existence of God, modified to avoid specifying the nature or identity of the designer. This is a little quote from the top of the page of the Wikipedia. So if when you look at this, this is of course it's talking about religion, and when you're talking about artificial life and you're building your system and playing around with it, you are a designer, and it's a considerable challenge. I'm really interested what Justin would have to say about this, but it's a considerable challenge to be able to put something together and then convince yourself and others that you're not influencing it to a great degree. Justin, what do you think about that?
Wow. So the question is very complicated.
How can you convince yourself and others that it's an intelligent design? Because, of course, you build the whole system in order to create the possibility. So, you know, in sort of a metaphorical way, you're the creator.
Okay, so, my perspective is that cracking the algorithm of evolution by natural selection does not make one the creator. So when I argue that life, even as trivially simplistic as what we're creating in silico, what I try to say, and I mentioned this in the last podcast, was that bacteria, as an example. So if we take one theory on the rise of life on Earth, was that RNA, okay, under very cold conditions, maybe with like cyanide and ammonia, coming together in tiny, tiny pockets of liquid water that was trapped in ice. And this is one of the approaches to life on Earth, which is that it's under cold conditions as opposed to hot conditions. If you have cyanide and ammonia coming together, they can give rise to nucleotides such as adenine. Once you have that, they can then segment together to create RNA, again, under cold conditions, we've demonstrated, and this has been published research, that these very primitives can become active as the first enzymes, right, that would then encourage them to connect and replicate. And once you have replication and variety, you've got life, in my opinion. And that's how I define life, is a very trivial, very simplistic approach. And then through artificial life, by the approach that we're using, the understanding that I have as the artificial life community is doing, what we're doing is actually creating the very basic, almost nucleotides. In silico, it's just machine code. And this could be like an arbitrary probabilistic encoding set, like what Adam has been doing.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm glad you used the word create, because you are the creator.
I don't want people to think that by creating or cracking the algorithm of life, if you will, that then begs a proof for a concept of intelligent design. But I would very much like to hear what your thoughts are about this.
I'd like to have Jeffrey's insight here to caveat this by saying that I think there's a plurality of approaches, Justin, which I think is where Gerald is coming from in some regard. There are a number of approaches that are used by contemporary artificial life developers, and I think we may be moving towards, and perhaps even Brig Kleiss, for all that he has done in the discussion, is forced a kind of reevaluation about the first principles that artificial life developers are using. But Jeffrey, in terms of Justin and Gerald's discussion, what's your thought about what you do in GenePool in terms of intelligent design?
Well, I think that we can only be intelligent designers. We have no choice, because we're humans and we make artifacts and we model reality. And unless or until we actually create something that becomes a persistent life form and comes of its own, in which case perhaps it is still intelligent design because we created it in the first place, even though it becomes autonomous. But putting that aside, as people who are trying to understand life and model it and simulate it, I think that we have no choice but to be intelligent designers. But what we focus on are the things that this artifact that we make do, which is autonomous and which sheds light on the real bottom-up evolutionary phenomena that we're trying to understand. So I don't see a huge conflict here in terms of what we're doing. I think that what we tried to do is create simulations or create environments in which a significant amount of emergence comes about that we can then point to and talk about in terms of its autonomy. That's my viewpoint.
So is this the idea of the artificial life developer almost as a kind of creative gardener, that they have a confined space that they are able to cultivate in some regard in order to see more beautiful flowers or things of this nature? Is this what you're saying, Jeffrey?
I think our hand is always in it. We can never remove our hand from it entirely. We try to remove our hand from it as much as we possibly can and talk about the manner in which we've removed our hand from the process. I think that's the nature of what we do.
But Jeffrey, this is Justin. May I just jump in? What are the implications? I mean, intelligent design versus evolution by natural selection is a red-hot political and scientific debate. And
it's not a scientific debate.
I agree completely.
just said it was, so I just had to jump in.
Okay. Well, what do you all think then? If we say that what we're doing is intelligent design, is there a possibility that we might be co-opted and used as a proof for some very bad science?
I want as much co-opting as possible, because I think what it is we are doing is exactly intelligent design. We're doing our very best to create entire sort of worlds, entire sort of self-sufficient ecosystems, whatever, evolution systems that give us surprises, whatever. We're doing intelligent design. That's what we do.
Actually, Gerald, I think that I know what you're saying, but our purpose and our goal is different. We're not trying to say there is a God, there is a intelligent being. In fact, our goal might even be the opposite.
I don't think we're saying anything about that subject whatsoever.
No, exactly. But I think maybe what Justin is saying is that by you saying we are doing intelligent design, there is an implication that we are taking sides with the intelligent design mindset, which is not what we're doing.
All right.
That's exactly what I was saying.
Okay, I'm definitely in agreement with that.
Yeah, that's the reason why I'm so cautious about using intelligent design with anything that we do or that I do. I won't speak for others, because I'm incredibly concerned that it might be co-opted by people with an agenda that's not about promoting science or advancing humanity's knowledge about how we live in this world, but rather to promote a medieval mindset that is focused on dragging us backwards rather than allowing us to look forward and create a future for ourselves. And I'll use that word create a future for ourselves that's beautiful and powerful and allows us to live the ways that we want to.
If you say what we're doing with creating artificial life is intelligent design, I don't think it's really doing anything more than shedding light on what is the idea of intelligent design. Like we can, if you can sort of get into the head of somebody who's building an artificial life project, you get an idea of what it is to stand outside of something and to manipulate it until it becomes something interesting. And that idea of intelligent design in the religious context is absolutely absurd, and this just sheds more light on it and makes it more, you know, close to home. You can get a real feel for what it would be to be a designer, and you can see how silly the whole idea is.
That's certainly my feeling working on Dick Gordon's book, particularly communicating with creationists who are, and I want to be very clear, the intelligent design, capital I, capital D, intelligent design is in fact a phenomena which is in some regards quite removed from creationism. It is very much from my reading and from working with Dick Gordon, this mentality of a deity as a software engineer or something like that. I mean, I can't, in the writings that I have read in that regard. But this is an interesting point that Justin is making, and I think certainly one that is highly topical in terms of the ability of this capital I, capital D, intelligent design movement to corrupt participants who are in fact in no way connected with them. And I think this is something that we can think about quite a bit in terms of our own development of artificial life and the terminology which we use. But it also extends back to this kind of methodological discussion that, Gerald, you made in terms of what we are actually doing with regards to its impact and interaction on science. And certainly this idea of the hobbyist, the trained, you know, obsessive fellow tinkering in his basement is something that has gelled with me through the week in terms of this metaphor. I think there is also a distinction between your position and Justin's position in terms of the view that there can be reaching back from artificial life into science in terms of assistive and reinforcing components. Would you like to talk about that, please, Justin, to start off with?
Well, I mean, I think I feel like I've talked a lot. I'd like to hear more from Gerald and Jeffrey, if that's okay.
Certainly.
I've been saying a lot, and I think I need to learn more and listen more rather than talk, if that's okay, because
certainly,
I want to understand their points.
I think all of us have really experienced firsthand how difficult it is to create a piece of software that is actually capable of giving you a surprise and a sort of a positive surprise. That this is a huge challenge. You could say it's sort of the central challenge of what we do, which I would call intelligent design. So we're trying to create a design so intelligent that it actually surprises us.
It's actually something that's part of what game developers try to do as well. If you play a game and there are no surprises and nothing interesting, nothing that challenges you, that it's not a very good game. So perhaps all of software development or everything we make could be described as this. I mean, you want to create something that's going to give you back more than what you put into it.
Do you feel that you've done that, Jeffrey?
All the more intelligent the design, actually.
Yeah.
Do you feel through your own work you've been able to achieve this, Jeffrey?
Not enough. only to a small degree. And I'm trying to do more of that. I think the challenge is that I'm trying to make the simulation on a lower level, to simulate lower layers of emergence to create the same emergence that's happening, but that demands more compute power and more time, and it becomes less interesting for viewers, and it becomes more difficult. So it's a craft, for sure.
So if we can look at this as an idea of taking intelligence out of the equations, it's an idea of being a sub-intelligent designer in some regard, that what you're trying to do is create from dynamic equations and things which cannot be, maybe by some, but by most that actually deal with these kind of equations, cannot have attributed intelligence per se, and then actually build something that creates the likes of Gene Pool, that creates the likes of Darwin at Home, that creates the likes of these simulations. And I know, Gerald, our discussion last year with regards to returning to first principles with Darwin at Home was in some regard to kind of recreate this intelligence from much simpler principles.
Yeah, I mean, this is like an incredibly central challenge, and you know, before I can call something artificial life, I have to be quite convinced that that it has delivered me a couple of really convincing surprises that I can't just explain away. And so, you know, I'm very cautious to use the word artificial life until I'm really impressed by the design that
we need to really. I'm sorry. Can I jump in?
Sure.
We need to really get Adam involved in these discussions. I mean, for all of the, you know, debates that Adam and I have between the two of us on the personal level, what he has done with AutoCore, which is an artificial life form that he's created, I would strongly argue that he has created a life form that actually is surprising in what it develops. For example, when he set the little buggers free and they actually started to evolve or grow an algorithm for pattern recognition and achieve something like 85% accuracy against the Berkeley test data set in less than 2 days, that was completely novel, completely unexpected, and amazing to me. And that to me was the proof, so to speak, that we could effectively create an artificial life form, a real life form. I hate using the word artificial. It's a life form that exists in silica that is as novel and as different and as evolvable as, you know, any bacteria on Earth, which could ultimately become humans.
Hey, Jeffrey, Justin, what if somebody came up to you and they had a way of doing the pattern recognition based on some sort of matrices and some sort of mathematics you didn't understand, and damn it, if it didn't work twice as fast as those life forms? Would you call it artificial life then? I mean, what's the difference?
But isn't all of the universe nothing more than a giant computation that's unfolding in real time?
Well, there we go. You heard it here first, folks. That's it.
I think I've heard it here a few times, Gerald. I think that seems to be a recurring theme.
What was that? I didn't catch that.
No, I mean, absolutely. That's the case. You know, it's a vast the universe has vast computing power. There are billions of atoms in each cell, and they're all calculating exactly what they're going to do next.
That might be debatable. I don't know.
That's true.
Whether it's computation, whether you can call it computation at that level, but certainly there are some laws being affected. I had a kind of a crazy idea that I wanted to throw out. Tom, is this a good time for me to throw out a crazy idea?
It's what this radio show is all about.
Okay, here's my crazy idea. So I don't believe in intelligent design. However, when thinking about the future of humanity and how if we want to continue to seek immortality and increase our population, we might have to leave planet Earth in order to save it, in which case we'll try to inhabit other planets. And, of course, you know, we're continuing to explore that, and that's called panspermia, where we take our DNA and we go to other places. When you think about our future efforts and our trajectory into the future, it makes it a little more easy to imagine that perhaps some seed came down onto Earth. And I'm not saying I believe this or not, but it's just a kind of an idea to sort of put intelligent design into perspective, that perhaps if we were to say we're going to try to inhabit planet X in 2,000 years, and so we're going to start by throwing a package of DNA that we've designed to seed that planet, and then by the time we arrive, there will be an atmosphere. Is that intelligent design? And that planet then evolves, of course, because that's the program.
Well, that's a pretty good A-Life project, yeah.
let's get started.
Here's my concern with regards to panspermia, and it could be just an ignorance with regards to the topic, but the idea that there is some genetics that exists on Earth that could be useful or benefit being on another planet, let's say, I've always found rather strange in terms of how, I mean, panspermia isn't, to completely mix metaphors, isn't a Noah's Ark idea. It's not an idea that there were lots of different kinds of genetics that,
I think you got to think in terms of like the core, you know, ability to replicate molecules. You know, if something like that arrives on a planet, then, you know, you get started on the whole evolution process without, you know, beforehand determining whether you use oxygen or something else, you know,
yeah.
Just the simple fact that you can replicate molecules.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
Isn't that extremely arrogant to assume that that couldn't exist on their planet? I mean, I think that's my concern with panspermia is there's always an idea that there's something coming from out there that is better than what exists here.
It's just a question. No, it's a probability argument, Tom. Nothing more. You know, you've got billions of places in the universe, and it might be just that unlikely that life arrives, that it just happens to be spreading on the basis of, you know, a few replicating molecules landing somewhere. It's not an argument for intelligent design in any respect, because you just take one step further.
Wouldn't
they
burn up in the atmosphere first?
Sorry.
I said, wouldn't they burn up in the atmosphere first? I think that kind of concept has got a lot of problematic issues in it, unless you're actually, you know, finding a particular planet, landing on it, and then trying to cultivate molecules. I think that there needs to be, you know, some kind of delivery vehicle and then some sort of guidance. You can't just drop, you know, replicating machines as simple biomatter to kind of seed a planet.
Are you saying there should be an atmosphere first?
Because yeah,
no,
the atmosphere
I, okay.
Actually, my understanding is that the atmosphere was created by early life forms. It's a continual feedback system that we call Gaia. So I don't know if the atmosphere comes first. It's a chicken and the egg. That's my understanding.
Good point.
It's amazing to me because Robert has been working on this platform, which he calls Sim Gaia. So Robert, let's hear you wade into the debate to throw you in front of the bus, so to speak.
All right. Well, if you're going to throw me in front of the bus, then, well, I would think that, you know, and I'm not a scientist or biologist by any means, so, you know, take my comments with a grain of salt, but,
None of us are, I think.
Okay, well, then I don't feel too bad. But I think that you kind of almost would have to have an atmosphere first, because if you're going to, you know, either create life or, you know, evolve life or have it, you know, spontaneously exist or whatever, there has to be some sort of environment that's conducive to that. And a perfect example would be, you know, artificial life on a computer. You can't have it without the existence of the computer first. You know, so I don't know if that's necessarily a really good analogy there. But I think that
another one is that DNA doesn't replicate can't replicate on its own. It requires a cell around it to replicate.
It requires a medium of some sort.
Exactly. And I think maybe that's probably part of my argument.
DNA requires...
They're needing
to go ahead
first. Oh, my God.
Well, I don't think it's correct that DNA... Well, RNA certainly doesn't need a cell membrane in order to replicate.
No, there's a whole bunch of mechanisms that are required for DNA, though, as far as I know.
Yeah, but RNA was the precursor to DNA, is my understanding. And my background is biochemistry. That's what I studied.
Yeah, I think Justin is right.
What's that?
I agree with you, Justin. But I think...
I think
continue, Justin, sorry.
Oh, go ahead, please. You go ahead.
My concern with the panspermian argument is more methodological than anything in some regard, and it seems to be used very heavily as a QED proof by a wide variety of people for a wide variety of reasons. Returning to Brig Kleist specifically and his challenge to the artificial life community based on his own panspermian views, the only positive that I could take away from that, aside from the fact that no money was actually offered and a wide variety of other things, was that he was setting down a challenge that we are also setting ourselves explicitly today, that we need to start thinking in terms of very low-level principles in creating, future artificial life development. And maybe this is what Adam has already done. Adam is welcome to participate in these shows. I send out an explicit invitation to Adam, both through audio and via email following. But I think the idea of intelligent design in terms of the designer being intelligent versus what the designer creates being intelligent is a distinction that probably needs to be made as well.
That's a good point.
I prefer the latter definition, where the designer is not necessarily so intelligent.
Well, perhaps we've shown that with regards to our collective biological knowledge today.
Yeah.
If I could jump in again, I've got another, I guess, observation or something. It seems that, getting back to part of the earlier conversation, when we were talking about, Jesse had mentioned that he was surprised by the results of one of the programs that we're working on. I think that there's a distinction between being surprised at the speed or the result that something comes up with versus being surprised at the process as a method that the artificial life or the simulated whatever it does on its own. I think that's really where the uniqueness comes in at, where it being unexpected is part of the surprise, because it's not something that's statically programmed, or you say we only want you to do A, B, or C, and we expect D, E, or F at the end, but then the project returns an X or an L. Having said that, and then kind of trying to link a little bit really quickly to the comments that we just had about an environment necessary to, kind of grow or stimulate something, it seems that a lot of people, at least in the business community, in my experience, are, see things like artificial life, artificial intelligence, whatever, and have a bit of a hard time trying to see how it can apply to what they're doing and how it helps them. And, if they look on the internet for artificial life stuff, a lot of times they'll come up with these little programs where things kind of evolve, little natural selection kind of simulation goes on, and you end up with some pretty graphics on the screen, or one little bit of code or snippet that replicates itself better than anybody else does, and that's kind of it. And then you have all these individual engineer guys working in their basements or whatever trying to develop their version of artificial life or simulated life, and that's kind of it. I'm wondering if maybe what we need at this point is to kind of create some kind of virtual life incubator, whether it's on a game platform or some other method, but kind of take things out of the 2D pixels running around on the screen and making some kind of arbitrary environment, with or without atmosphere. I mean, it doesn't have to be a full-blown thing with plants and mountains, but some kind of shared environment where engineers can kind of create their own simulations or whatever, but have them interact with other simulations and try to see if there's any really true unexpected evolutions or combinations of programs or whatever. So I guess I'm proposing some kind of open testing network environment.
You are actually proposing Bruce Damer's EvoGrid project perfectly, because my understanding is that is exactly what Bruce is trying to do. Now, you make three really interesting points. The last one you made with regards to the EvoGrid, we've discussed at great length, and I had some methodological concerns with regards to that, which we can probably return to. The first point you made, which I thought was said very beautifully, is that there is a lot of wonder to go around. And basically, whilst we may not see aspects in wonder in one aspect of what we develop with artificial life, clearly there is some kind of collective wonder that we still get out of artificial life development. And I think that is a fascinating point that we should take away. Now, your second point has skipped my mind. Can you refresh me?
It's kind of skipped my mind too. I was kind of going in a rush there.
Yes, it was with regards to the idea that we were all kind of collectively tinkering in our basements with regards to a single idea of genetic algorithms. And that, I think, is one point that I'd like to correct, that what I see in contemporary artificial life development is actually a plurality of ideas. Some of us develop explicitly with regards to fitness functions and genetic algorithms, and others of us look at social phenomena, and others of us look at abilities to move through various algorithms, and others of us look at various aspects of sustained behavior, and these kind of things come together in Bruce Damer's EvoGrid in terms of actually finding what combination of all of these algorithms could fit together best. Now, the interesting point that you raise is our ability as a kind of collective to explain things to business and industry, which was my question back to Justin initially. What is your particular insight with regards to that, Robert, in terms of what needs to occur?
My perspective is heavily, biased from the game, the game industry and entertainment media sort of thing. So that's kind of where my strength is. I think that ultimately it all boils down to showing somebody something, showing them the wonderful killer app, at work, and then suddenly see all the light bulbs go on, and people are like, oh my God, I could use that for this, or this. So I think that we kind of need to find, that perfect project or that perfect, platform or something that can really show off in a very practical and demonstrative sort of perspective how these technologies can be used and leveraged. The easiest one, I would think, would certainly be the game industry. And I guess my point there is, we talked earlier about, how content is sometimes surprising and dynamic, and these games tend to surprise gamers. But I would argue that, at least in today's, contemporary, online gaming, world, that things have become very static, very predictable, and very repetitive. And one of the things that could, almost evolutionize or revolutionize the entire interactive media industry would be leveraging artificial life, artificial intelligence to create adapting and evolving environments where the content isn't scripted so much anymore, where you're killing the same thing over and over in the same spot, but the creatures or characters in the game start responding unpredictably, or they band together in different ways and fashions, and the worlds change or grow, or even the implementation of seasons on some kind of realistic scale would have a dramatic effect. But
do you think Spore does that currently, Robert? I mean, from your indications of Spore, do you think Spore is an entry-level game, or do you think it's something that's completely different?
I think it's completely different. When Spore was initially announced and shown off, it generated a lot of excitement. Mostly because there's a lot of procedurally dynamic, content generation that's going on. However, there's still a limit on, what you can kind of create, what you can work with. And the gameplay's kind of changed a little bit. And it's, from people that I've talked to recently, it's not quite, what we all thought it was going to be from the very beginning. I mean, it's still pretty fantastic, and it's probably a good, as you said, entry point for the common man on the street with an Xbox or whatever, to kind of get an idea of how things can evolve and change, and from a physical interaction standpoint with the world that you interact with. But I think that from a different perspective, from how things would respond to somebody else's actions or interactions, it's kind of on a different level.
Do you think there's a potential for Spore to actually damage the collective that we are trying to create through the games industry, in terms of it being over budget, over time, and potentially still an unknown in terms of its general success?
I would say yes and no. I think no, in the sense that it's going to be probably fantastically successful, and it's going to reach out to a very broad mass market. I think it will introduce a lot of people to some basic concepts of how things evolve and being able to kind of go in and tweak things at different levels and kind of grow. So I think it's good in that respect. On the other hand, you're right, it is very costly. It has taken a long time. It is, over time, over budget. And, when it comes out, it may or may not be meeting the expectations of people like us or more sophisticated crowd. And the downside to that, and this actually happened as an industry as a whole for the MMO industry, is that if something previously done appears to be expensive or hard to do or difficult, everybody else doesn't want to touch it or go anywhere near it, and that tends to stifle innovation in other new projects. But you might see a lot of copycat projects that look a lot like Spore, function a lot like Spore, and then we end up with 5 to 10 years worth of the same thing kind of rehashed over and over instead of much more vibrant, innovative environment that kind of catalyzes people to.
But sometimes something else which is a little bit similar to it kind of takes over the role of inspiring people in that area. So for instance, Second Life, created by Linden Lab, and I worked there for 2 years recently, is in a position to, a lot of people are paying attention to it, not simply because of things that emerge socially, but also the economic emergence, the virtual economy in there. And so, if we were to get more artificial life-like things happening in Second Life, then I think maybe people might shift their attention from Spore, which is very top-down, very expensive, very very industry, to Second Life, which is a lot more grassroots-oriented. They might see that that might be the place where these kinds of things will emerge. I don't know if that relates to what you're saying.
A little bit it does, and it kind of gets back to something I mentioned earlier. Personally, I think that Second Life is the king of the hill that's waiting to be knocked over, and will probably be knocked over pretty soon.
Say that again? I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said I think Second Life is the current king of the hill, but is likely to be knocked off the hill pretty soon. I think that it's probably time as an industry for the successor to come along. That's something maybe a little more vibrant or more powerful. It's not. I don't know. I don't want to get into too much of an anti-Second Life rant going on, but I think that there's opportunity there, and I think that in the past, year or two, it's developed a bit of a public relations black eye on several levels, and so I think that shifting focus from something like Spore to trying to get people to go back to Second Life or taking a look at Second Life or trying to do artificial life experimentation in an environment like that might not be necessarily the best option.
Robert, are you familiar with the PlayStation 3 game Flow at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they have a web version, I believe.
Certainly. It started initially in a web version. In terms of its reception by the game community, both in terms of the game journalism community and also the general players, it was an interesting possible example as well in terms of introducing some of the concepts of artificial life to a playing audience. What was your feeling with regards to how it was received?
I thought it was received pretty spectacularly. I was pretty shocked the first time I saw it because it was both simple and sophisticated at the same time. It was very well designed. It was very creative. And by a very small team of people with relatively little or no budget. Everybody I've talked to that has seen it or looked at it or that I've shared it with had pretty much the same response. If there were if I had a larger budget and, some time, I would have bent over backwards to hire those guys myself.
Have you seen Jeffrey's Gene Pool at all?
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Okay, because my understanding, and certainly I did quite a bit of work with regards to Biota, it was that most of Flow, and one can show this academically, and I did a podcast in the Ape Reality feed on this, actually came from Jeffrey's both published and available online work with regards to Gene Pool. And it's fascinating actually looking at that and looking at the structure of the papers were published back-to-back by one of Genova Chen's associates who also had connections with Biota. So the interesting thing was, and I'm not sure whether this was where University of Southern California got involved or where they got involved, but the breaking of Genova Chen's work from Jeffrey's work and from the artificial life community was done probably around the time of the first Wired article, which I think was in November 2006. So it's fascinating looking at Flow as being probably of closer genealogy to certainly Jeffrey's work and the artificial life community than has occurred with Spore explicitly. But I think the aesthetic and you know, the whole kind of idea that Jeffrey portrays very well through Gene Pool and through his published work Associated was certainly very evident in Flow. But the feedback that I've received from folks in the game journalism community and game players was that Flow had a kind of mixed response, because it was perhaps not marketed in the right way, perhaps didn't have the right final look and feel for a kind of traditional game-playing audience, and certainly the final screenshots and the video that I'm seeing of Spore, which will now be released in September this year, I believe, seems to indicate that the final aesthetic has been tinkered with to make it slightly more cartoony rather than perhaps what more traditional artificial life developers would have liked to have seen in some regard. But I think the idea of aesthetic and the general look and feel that artificial life can bring to the games community is something that could almost evolve out of the Evo grid. If we have the Evo grid running for a certain period of time and we work out in a kind of, I don't know whether it's fundamentally kind of Spencerian battle of the various algorithms to see which looks the best, the aesthetic winners could then be scooped up into an artificial life SDK that was then put out to the game development community. Robert, in your view, I mean, in my own experience talking to relatively high-level people at EA and THQ, is that they are just clamoring for an artificial life SDK that they can just slot into their games. What's your own view with regards to this, Robert?
Yeah, I think that there's certainly industry demand for it, but if you sit down and actually talk to people, nobody really knows how to define what it is they want. So it's like, I would kill for an artificial life, middleware or SDK I could use, but no, I can't really tell you what I need it to do or how I think it should be structured. It's kind of one of those strange things where I guess a lot of developers really haven't sat down and thought it through, mostly because they've been, you know, too preoccupied with trying to cram more polygons coming out of the graphic engine or trying to do more realistic particle effects or artificial life is usually limited to, you know, pre-scripted responses, particular, you know, event queues and stuff. So I think that you'd kind of almost have to find a couple of developer guys that are willing to sit down and help flesh out the specifications for what the SDK need to do, what kind of format they need it in, you know, what kind of API they kind of necessarily need, and, go from there. And then once you have some kind of working, you know, alpha or beta and kind of get that into a development process somewhere, then I think that suddenly a lot of gears will perk up and people will be clamoring at the door for access.
Certainly we have the advantage on this call of not necessarily having someone of the right age group, but Gerald's son, Mitch, has tinkered with Second Life and I'm assuming also plays various games. Gerald, in terms of Mitch's age group, what do you see the components of artificial life that could go into kind of contemporary game development to keep the likes of Mitch interested?
Well, I've got my kid has been playing games since he was really tiny, and from all sorts of different games all the way through unbelievable numbers of them and discovering them all. And he had a lot of fun with Second Life for a while, scripting up things like fireworks and guns and things like this. And it was all very interesting. And when I talk about artificial life with him, he says, "Yeah, that would make these things a lot more interesting and make it, you know, something that you could keep working with instead of something that gets boring, because he moves from game to game to game to game." I think the real gaming community right now is like the World of Warcraft addicts and things like that. And I wonder if like World of Warcraft, would that be not a good place to have some artificial life ready to kill you or to be killed?
I think the only way to do it through World of Warcraft currently is to write your own interactive bots, which would literally be scripted probably from the keyboard or mouse level at the end player. So I think World of Warcraft is so heavily closed currently that the only way to do it is actually to have a virtual player that was interacting with the World of Warcraft environment through mouse movements and keyboards kind of remotely.
That's actually a bannable offense with World of Warcraft, because so many people have actually tried that for gold farming or for getting a lot of items to kind of sell on third-party websites.
So they're against us from every angle.
Oh, absolutely. At least World of Warcraft. There's other games, maybe not as much, but yeah, Blizzard will come after you.
Hey, Tom, I've been listening to the podcast with you talking with Bruce about the Evo grid, and this is it's a really interesting dream, but I wonder, what are the very, very first steps that can possibly be made to bring different forms of artificial life together? Because what I'm imagining is, you know, some forms of artificial life are 2D, some of them are 3D, some of them are 1D, you know, they're from completely different domains. So I'm just curious, what could you possibly do to make the first step towards the Evo grid? What is it?
It's a means of communication. That's the first step. It doesn't require any discussion of dimensionality. And here I may be completely diverging from Bruce's particular view, but my particular view with regards to this is that it's fundamentally a means of communication. It's an API.
Protocol. Okay.
I would agree with that. And in fact, that what you want to do is don't even tell each other about what, like Tom said, your dimension or anything like that, or frame rate or simulation nature. Just what is your API? How are you communicating to each other? What's your protocol? And once you establish that, which is, of course, an iterative process, you work on that over time. Once you've established that, everything that you do should just work.
And the other fascinating angle to that is with regards to the viewers, because if you separate it through protocol, you then have the option of people with Brevet viewers, with gene pool viewers, with Darwin at Home viewers, with Noble 8 viewers to observe the other entities interacting in the shared space. And
yeah,
what will happen?
That sounds believable until you really start thinking about what that means. I really have trouble imagining it. I'm sorry.
Okay, so
imagine this.
Let me give you as best a description as I can give, because I've been thinking about this a lot recently as well. Noble 8 is fundamentally planar currently, although I would like to have 3D space. But the planar representation of Noble Ape over a kind of, you know, 2.5-dimensional wave function allows for a particular kind of aesthetic. If I was to move just the location of the Noble Apes into a Brevet environment, it would then be John Klein's responsibility to create some kind of API that would represent a point in space. So what you have is you have a shared minimalist API description, but he may also want to add, hey, this is a Noble Ape, or hey, this is Framsticks, or hey, this is one of Gerald Jung's Darwin at Home Walkers, or even better, import AI planets, ducks and sharks and things like that. And then he chooses how he wants to represent it in his own environment. Now, in terms of the 2D, 3D problem, it is then his responsibility in terms of graphical rendering how he wants to represent it. But what you will then have is a situation where the artificial life developer is removed from the renderer in some regard, because as come up frequently in these chats, there are a number of renderers out there that do a remarkably good job at their particular rendering space and would probably do a better job than we are doing in our particular artificial life space. So all you do is you give these very simple protocols that define points in space or define the potential of small movement if that's allowed by the renderer, and then this is then represented by the collective environment. So in my case, unfortunately, I would probably be the cheapest and nastiest of the renderers. You know, your Darwin at Home forms would be represented by dots on the Noble Ape landscape as they kind of prodded the Noble Apes and things like that. However, in Brevet, they would be represented in the full specification that you could provide online that John Klein could then implement, and if you were both using Java, so much the better. So what the protocol
you're still making an assumption about the idea that the individuals that you're creating are occupying 3D space.
In other words, they're fundamentally 2D space. It's the choice of the renderer how they represent the, how they resolve the objects down.
Okay.
Perhaps you could say that a Noble Ape is as if it were projected by a slide projector down onto the three-dimensional space.
So it's not really the idea that these different life forms or these different artificial life projects are going to interact in this way in any, I mean, it's pretty hard to bring a 2D creature in contact with a 3D creature. I don't know if you've met many 2D people, but
I meet plenty of them.
Okay.
Well, I mean, in fact, my interaction with all of you is not in 3D, Gerald, so...
It's in 1D, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I digress heavily, but you did force the digression. So this is the idea with regards to the Evo grid. And you're right, it does then push the responsibility, but I think what will happen through this is firstly artificial life developers will start thinking outside their own particular environments, and secondly, we will all converge on the better graphical representations eventually. So this, in fact, hybridizes not just the artificial life algorithms in terms of their interactions, but also hybridizes the visualization associated with artificial life and a wide variety of other components like the environment and things like that, which we haven't even discussed.
I think the most difficult part would be the physics. I mean, visualizing is one thing, but if you know, there are so many different ways of doing the physics or doing the laws of how things interact with each other, which could be an extension of physics. And that is, of course, converging because now more and more games are using Havok and these certain sort of packaged physics programs. But, you know, in the case of what all of us are doing, we probably all have our own sort of idiosyncratic physics algorithms. And if we could sort of establish a common grid or a common sort of ticking of time, however you want to describe it, that we just sort of lock our physics into that, it may degrade in transition, but at least it's been translated.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Jeffrey, because the stuff I'm working on now, what I want to evolve is spatial things. So a lot of focus goes into making the physics as simple and as computationally effective as possible. So I shortcuts left and right. It's a totally specialized thing in order to be able to accelerate time to the highest degree possible.
Exactly.
And, you know, once these things have evolved, I mean, I can imagine with Darwin at Home creatures or with gene pool creatures as well. Once they've evolved, once they've gone through their whole process, they can maybe appear somewhere else, you know, in their finished form. But I really can't imagine there being enough of a commonality between the physics as you described them.
Well, they all have extension over time and extension over space, and as long as we can make translations. You know, I think that's where it all starts.
Then this is step one, then, Tom. This is exactly what I was asking for. So what they have in common is space.
And time.
And time.
And time, yeah.
And from space and time, you can get other things like energy and various other physics properties as well that come out of that.
So finding the superset of all properties that if you choose, let's say, just choose five very different artificial life scenarios, what is the set of things that they have in common? What are the things they don't have in common? And try to glean the sort of the universals of all of those. And that
it's an extremely tall order. It's extremely, extremely difficult. The more you try to do it, the more you realize how difficult it is.
Yeah, it's a PhD, in fact, right?
Funnily enough.
That's why I think that's why Bruce is looking at the PhD.
Yeah, and research research is something that can end in a conclusion that it was not possible.
Yes, yes.
That's why it's research.
I think we're all optimistic, though.
But your PhD advisors may not like that response.
Hey, it's science, man. It's science.
I agree completely.
Okay, so in the wrap-up, we have 9 minutes left, and I wanted to give Robert a chance to plug his work, and then we'll go through the various plugs and the wind-downs as opposed to going into overtime. Robert, for folks interested in reading more about you and potentially seeing some of your work and things of this nature, how do they get a hold of you?
There's three easy ways. You can find me on LinkedIn.com. You can go to my blog, which is CuriousRaven.squarespace.com, or you can just do an Amazon search and look for my book, MMO Evolution.
Very nice. Gerald, have you had a few more weeks at the Architects? A few more Fridays?
Oh. Yeah, I've had a couple more since we talked last, and things are progressing wonderfully as of actually last night or this morning at 1 a.m. I'm finally got a number of things working, and it's starting to look really good. I'm able to grow tensegrities now, which is something I've been dreaming about for quite a long time. And these are the nice thing about them is that they're so extremely minimal. You can imagine, you know, having them really live in highly accelerated time. So
in terms of wonder, having said that you're not feeling enough wonder with regards to your project, you're currently feeling a lot of wonder with regards to it.
Oh, definitely. It's there are doors opening. I've been asked by the architects as well to give a presentation at a get-together that they're having with a whole diversity of people, so I'm going to get a chance to tell my story to all crowd.
Wonderful. It just sounds like an artificial life nirvana. I mean, every time you talk about this, and please produce more podcasts as well, so we can hear from you on a kind of week-to-week basis in terms of the excitement and the stuff that's going on currently, because it's all very nice. Jeffrey, in terms of your continued development with the new version of GenePool, how's it all going?
It's it's actually going well. I'm doing it all almost entirely on the Mac, and I can port it over to the PC, so it'll run on both Mac and PC. And
very
and
nice.
The graphics are so beautiful on the Mac, I don't even want to go back to the PC anymore, so I'm forcing myself, holding my nose, and going back to the PC and working there as well, so that it's cross-platform. And I'm also talking to Philip Rosedale at Linden Lab about kind of rejuvenating an old idea that we've had, building some sort of intelligent kind of things existing in Second Life that perhaps is attached to a Google or some of the big search spaces out there, so that we can grow things out of the intelligence that's already existing on the internet.
I was talking to Bruce over the week with regards to you being the ideal candidate for the first Evo Grid development because of your, I think you're a couple of hours away from Bruce, but you're still certainly closer than most of us are to Bruce currently. So if there was going to be any kind of physical Evo Grid get together, and this may also tie into the Silicon Valley Grey Thumb, I thought that you'd be the ideal simulator to participate as the first simulator in Evo Grid with regards to your new gene pool development.
Yeah, well, Bruce and I are planning on getting together on the 22nd of March, so hopefully we'll make headway.
Great. I look forward to hearing what that discussion brings. And Justin, you are going to be starting Grey Thumb London this week.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It should be a lot of fun. I'll also be over in San Diego as well as into Houston and some other parts of America on the first couple weeks of March.
Any chance you're swinging by Vegas?
I could probably swing something out if it needed to be. To come see you, Tom?
I'd love to see you. I would really like to have the opportunity to sit down and chat with you for an extended period of time. I think certainly you've created a degree of insight into aspects of artificial life that are novel and very useful in this Bio to Live segment. But it would be nice to have the opportunity to talk to you in real time and not have these artificial 4 minutes remaining kind of issues.
Well, Bruce and Jeffrey, where are you going to be meeting Bruce at?
Down in his place, down in the deep redwoods near Santa Cruz.
And let's see, I'll be in America the week of the 4th. Would you be available that week at all?
Is it April or March?
The 4th of March.
I'm off that entire time, and I should be able to organize a get-together with you if you were around in that time.
Okay, so that's I'll check that out and see what I can pull off.
Terrific.
Yeah, I would love to see everyone. I'm very excited about these calls. I think they're a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying it, and I really do think this is an incredible opportunity, and it's a real pleasure to meet everybody.
Definitely. So I could see you in three-dimensional form as opposed to one-dimensional form.
It might be nice.
Definitely. Well, with 3 minutes remaining, I think we've covered almost all aspects of this topic. Next week, next Friday, 8 p.m. Pacific, we're going to be discussing the outstanding questions. I'm not sure if Bruce Damon will be able to join us. He wasn't able to join us today. He is doing an improv class for. He's going to actually be, it's his PhD presentation, doing an improv of the Evo grid, which I think involves both demonstration on location and perhaps even Bruce Damer within the Evo grid as well. So he's doing an improv class today. However, he may be able to call in from the East Coast next week, and then we'll be off for 2 weeks. So following next Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific, I'll be off for 2 weeks. Aside from Justin potentially coming to town, I have a family member in town, so I'm taking some time off in order to catch up with 3D folk. And in addition to this, if folks want to contribute any questions for the live radio show next week, you can contact me directly through the Biota podcast page, biota.org/podcast, where I will also put up Robert and Justin and Jeffrey and Gerald's related projects, so you can check them out as well. The feedback we received last week from the music was very positive, so I may include new musical versions of the Biota Live theme. If you're interested, if you're a musician and would like to contribute a version of the Biota Live theme, please get in contact with me through the biota.org/podcast page. Thank you all very much for participating in probably one of the liveliest and best discussions on Biota Live to date. It's been a wonderful opportunity to share ideas.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Nice hanging out with you all. Thank you.